Okay, everyone.
Katya, thank you.
Yes, I'm going to welcome you all. How's the volume? I should turn it down a little, huh? No?
It's fine.
Is it okay?
Sounds good to me.
It's that awkwardness of hearing yourself. Welcome, everybody. Thanks for coming out on this special fall evening. I'm Katya, as most of you know, and I've been coordinating these research symposia. Thanks to Carolyn Spark, who started it many, many years ago. But thank you all for coming. It's funny, it always draws, you know, a different crowd, the different topics that we have. Just your interest makes this happen, so thank you for coming. And then I also want to welcome the online folks, because there's a lot of people who listen either that can't be here tonight because they don't live in the area, but there's been a lot of interest expressed in the topic, so that's why we use the microphone, so that we can record and they can download the talk afterwards. So as we go around tonight, and if you have questions or want to make comments, let's make sure to use the microphones so that it captures everything. And then I also wanted to say, if you're moved, we have a donation basket, and all of the funds go towards the our research fund for process work, and which is used to help with fill out our library and other projects that we have going on. And then tonight, our main topic is coma and brain injury recovery. So, as you all know, Pierre, that's all right, thanks. Oh yeah, that the official announcement I'm supposed to make, please turn off all your cell phones. Pierre will be talking tonight, and many of you might know, but and maybe you'll talk about your background more, Pierre, but before his life as a process worker and therapist, he's also a medical doctor, specializing, was it in neuro or brain recovery?
Well, I did work for 5 years in brain injury rehabilitation, yes. Okay. That was one of my specialties.
Great. Mm-hmm. Oh, and then I just wanted to say personally, in thinking about tonight, I was reflecting back. I had my a life-threatening illness when I was a teenager, and it was before I knew about process work, and so I was just thinking about what that would have been like to have known about it then, or to have my family have that kind of perspective, or the hospital staff. And it just made me really thankful for, you know, this field of process work, and then for everybody being willing to also share your experiences and help this area to grow, so that we have more possibilities for when we go through something like this ourselves or a loved one. So thank you. And so Pierre is going to be talking about his experience with working with people in coma and brain injury recovery, and then also there's several people here tonight who will be talking more personally about what they've been through. So welcome, everybody, and thank you for being here.
Well, thank you, Katya, for organizing this. And maybe as we are such a small group, shall we just say our names so everybody knows who is here. Is that okay? Do you want to start, Anasuya?
Is that working?
Yeah.
I'm Anasuya.
Annie.
Katya. I'm Makiko.
Hey.
Dale.
Hi, Dale.
I'm Crystal.
Hi, Crystal.
I'm Tom.
Hi, Tom.
I'm Svetlana.
Matthew.
Carl.
Thank you. Well, let me turn this off, this one off first. So what I thought that I would talk first, if, you know, few minutes, and but then I really want to give a few of my, well, friends or clients or colleagues the opportunity to share their stories, because I want to really get to hear what it is to be or to live through an experience like this, and that we learn from each other, not just from a medical perspective, but also from the lived experience, what it is to go through a head injury and to recover, and but to deal with the everyday changes that come along with head injury, which when you recover from the acute injury, it becomes a chronic illness. It's a chronic process, something that you live with, and you have to learn to live with and to cope and to adjust to the changes, and what that's all about and what is meaningful about it. Can you find some meaning in what happened to you as an accident or an injury, and learn to live with such a big experience and life-changing experience, and I want to think. So, first of all, just about my own background. As you said, Katya, I'm trained as a medical doctor. In Switzerland, I worked for many years as a medical doctor, and one of my jobs for 5 years, I was the assistant clinical director of a rehabilitation hospital in which we worked with people who had suffered both either spinal injuries or brain injuries. And I was kind of overseeing the department of brain injuries. And so we had a huge team of rehabilitation specialists, and that consists of medical doctors, different things like neurologists, but then internal medicine or other specialties. And we had neuropsychologists, physical therapist, occupational therapist, speech therapist. So a huge team that would work together to help people go through the different stages of living through an experience like this. And the patient would come to the hospital very briefly after their initial injury, meaning they would come maybe 1 or 2 days after their brain surgery, because many had to have surgical procedures done, and they would be treated in the emergency medicine, then in intensive care, and go through surgery. And then as soon as their brain pressure would be stable enough, we would get them, they would be transferred to our hospital. And so they would come often still in a deep comatose state, and then go through the different stages of recovery. Some would stay for a long time in coma, some would recover quite quickly, and then, but you know, have to deal with the consequences of the different brain injuries. And some would stay in the hospital for 2 years, and some would stay there for weeks only. So there was a huge range of different patients and different levels of care that we would have to go through. And then we also had an outpatient clinic for people to follow with the rehabilitation issues that clients had after leaving the hospital. They were mainly dealing with then psychological problems, but then also the issues of getting back into their work, to try to go back into some sort of gainful and employment and independence. So if you, I don't know if you know, brain injury, you can define it or categorize them in different ways. But one way, easy way to differentiate between different types of injuries is traumatic brain injury and non-traumatic brain injuries. So the non-traumatic brain injuries are injuries to the brain that are caused by medical issues such as a stroke or such as a heart attack that leads to the brain not getting enough oxygen, so suffering an injury from lack of oxygen or an infection. And then you have the traumatic brain injuries that are due to any types of direct trauma to the brain. And for the traumatic brain injuries or head injuries, you differentiate between the ones that are closed injury, there are no injuries to the skull, and injuries that come with a injury also to the skull. So the closed head injuries range from the mild traumatic brain injury that are kind of like concussions and to the more severe brain injuries that come with things. And concussions are very serious and they lead to brain injuries. And I don't know if you follow the news. I looked at the newspaper today, for example, in the Sunday New York Times, there's an article about the brain injuries caused by concussions of football players. That's has become a big issue now because there's more and more evidence that people who play these kind of violent sports develop brain injuries, even the ones that don't suffer concussions. So it's now even known that you don't need to suffer a concussion to develop a brain injury. The forces, the kind of the acceleration and deacceleration forces to the brain can cause brain injury by just shearing of the brain tissue. So you have the brain that is enveloped in a closed space and is enveloped by in a fluids in that supports us and protects us. But if you have strong forces to the brain, acceleration forms, that can lead to kind of shearing of some of the brain tissue that can cause neurological damage to the brain, long-term neurological damage to the brain. So, which was something that we didn't really No, and it's often the difficulty with that is that you can't document the damage to the brain. You can't see it in any scan. You don't see the effects. What you see is now with the functional brain imaging, you see that the function of the brain is altered. And at the time that when I worked in the hospital, you had to do a neuropsychological testing, meaning that you had to test for the cognitive problems that would result from this concussions or this mild traumatic brain injuries. Yes?
Yeah, I was going to say that I just saw today in USA Today,
yes,
which is Fridays, there was an article on the front page there about a blood test that they've just developed that will, it's a protein marker released by damaged brain cells. Mm-hmm. Anyway, it was just there just now, the day that they...
That's great. That's really something.
I didn't know if you've seen that or...
No, I didn't see that, and that was something that we were looking for, to find a way to test in the lab the consequences of
brain tumor.
I know there were some research doing, but I didn't know that it had actually resulted in an actual test now. But there was some. So let me read just a few paragraphs from the book, because I think to understand the dimension of brain injury, it's really important to know. So, for example, here it says, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, there's about 1.4 million people who suffer a traumatic brain injury a year in the U.S., and another 1.5 million who suffer mild traumatic brain injury. So, in total, about 3 million people a year that suffer a brain injury with more or less consequences. It's a huge, huge problem. And it's, some people call it a silent epidemic, because it's not something that you don't see it in the people with, you know, the people come and you don't see that they have had a brain injury and they suffer the consequences from a brain injury, unless you have such a severe injury that leads to, you know, paralysis of some of your body, of the limbs and something. But most people, many people with brain injury, you don't see it from the outside. So they get, it's one of the issues that then people will suffer from, that they see they don't feel that they've been recognized, or that they're recognizable as someone with a physical disability or problem. So, and then there's an estimate that about 5.3 million Americans currently have a long-term or lifelong need for help with daily living as a result of a traumatic brain injury. So because the brain is complex, every brain injury is different. Brain injury affects the injured person's subjective well-being, their self-confidence, independence, and life satisfaction, and it changes his or her social integration and social role. It can also impede the person's ability to self-manage behavior, which can lead to agitation or violence, and lower barriers to the abuse of alcohol and drugs. It often leads to depression, to post-traumatic stress disorder, and other psychiatric disorders, and to unemployment because of the loss of job skills. So brain injury itself is a chronic disease with high morbidity and mortality, meaning there's a lot of people who suffer a brain injury and also then also die from brain injury. Brain injury survivors often have lifelong motor function problems, injury-related medical issues such as epilepsy and chronic pain, and cognitive, psychiatric, and behavioral issues. Now, one of the issues is now also with brain injury is the current war in Iraq, and because of the special, how do you say, the special circumstances or new type of weapons that they're using, especially these improvised IUDs. IEDs, improvised explosive devices. So you have a lot of blast injuries that will affect a person's, you know, the skull. This is just a blast injury. You don't have to be, just to be this, again, this shaking of the brain. It is, medical treatment for brain injuries from the Iraq war will cost the government at least $14 billion over the next 20 years, according to a recent study. So an evaluation, and then that's also one of the issues. There is not enough specialized treatment for people with brain injuries. There's not enough needed services, and far too often an overwhelming logistical, financial, and psychological challenge. The quality and coordination of post-acute traumatic brain injury service system remains inadequate. When I look back at the services we were able to provide in Switzerland, that was quite extraordinary. And I don't think that at this time they can continue to provide the same type of services. The most patient who would come to the hospital would be insured by, in the Swiss system, by the accident insurance. And there was a national accident insurance plan that everybody had to have in Switzerland. And that accident insurance, which covered all, it's like a workers' comp insurance, covered all the payments for the services. And it was really, there was a lot of money, because there was a lot of interest in trying to get people back to work, so they would pay for a lot of services. But I think today, even today, there's, you know, the costs also have risen so much that I don't think that they could provide that much services anymore. So, yes?
Just to point out the book that you were reading from.
Oh.
He's shy. Pierre and Gary Reese just recently wrote that book. Pierre, maybe you want to say the title, and especially for folks who are going to listen online, maybe where they can get it.
So the book is called, thank you,
Katya. It's exciting. It just came out, a couple months ago?
Months ago. It's called Inside Coma, A New View of Awareness, Healing, and Hope. And you can get it through Amazon.
Great.
I think that's the best way to get it. And in this book, I'm talking a lot about also the work that we did in the hospital around communication with people who were actually in coma. So this is a method of applying some of the process work skills and the skills that Arnie and Amy Mindell have developed to really communicate with people who are not in a responsive state, who can't respond verbally, or they don't react in a normal, in a just conventional way. But today I want to also mainly focus on the issues that come when you wake up from the coma and you have to face life again, or face your environment and face the challenges to learn and cope with the results of the injuries. So when you look at the issues, you can look at different levels. There are medical aspects to the problem. Hi, hello.
Hi.
Welcome. So we just...
Sorry.
That's fine, no problem. No problem at all. I just want to say, my name is Pierre. I'm introducing the topic, and then we will have a few people share their own experience with the injury. So in a way, you can look at these medical aspects to the brain injury issue, what you do, how you treat the patient, how do you help them really get their skills back, how do you help them recover from the cognitive challenges that they have, how they can retrain to get back, to get their skills back. But then there's a huge social aspect to the issue. And the social aspect is, you know, the lack of services, but then the lack of recognition of that issue as a problem, and the lack of visibility of that that issue in itself. How to make that more, to raise the awareness and the information about brain injury with the general public. And then there are personal aspects to the issue. If you live through such an experience, or if you are part of a caregiver team, or if you're part of the family, these are really very personal aspects that are relevant. And from an individual who goes through that injury, some of the issue, you know, how do you recover? How do you get your life back? That's a big question. But how do you learn to live with, what has then become a chronic disease, a process that, in a way, that you will have to deal with for a long time. Chronic means, in my view, it can be very, very long, but it can be also just, you know, it can be limited to 6 months or 12 months or whatever, but it becomes a longer-term process. How do you make sense with the changes that you go through and that you experience? Some of the people with brain injuries will be very acutely aware of the difference from their, how they are now and how they were before the injury. Some don't have that awareness, because part of the injury is a process that some people call, it's called neglect. It's a neurological process that means that with some types of injury, the awareness about your situation is affected itself, so that you don't have that same awareness about your own situation. And so you can understand there's problems with being aware, and there might be problems with not being aware. It's just different. How do you find meaning, if you can at all? You know, can you find meaning in a experience that is so traumatic? Possibly, and sometimes possibly not. If you look from the perspective of the family, families are affected by the injury as much, well, not as much, but as well, in a very different way, but they're acutely affected by a process like this. You know, suddenly the whole life is disrupted, and they have to suddenly take on a role of a caregiver or caretaker, which, you know, you're not prepared to. How do you care for yourself? You have to care for your loved one, but then you care for yourself in the midst of going through the process of caring for your loved one. How do you make sense of the changes in your loved one? And how do you live, or do you deal with many family members go through a process of, you can call it something like survivor's guilt. It's a process of, you see your loved one in really facing huge challenges, and you are there, and you're not going through that, so you feel guilty about being the one that survived. Even if you weren't part of the accident, but you have these psychological processes that go along with being the one who is so-called healthy, and you have to deal with that fact. And as a helper or caregiver, if you're a professional helper, the questions are, how do you best facilitate the process of all these complex, complex aspects of such a quite intrusive and challenging process. Every story is really different, so you can't really rely on certain set of skills. You have to adjust your skills to each new client or patient, because everyone is very, very different. And how they react to the challenges, how the brain reacts to the challenges itself, but how the person and the family system reacts, is it will always be different. And so, I mean, I thought for tonight, I would like to have a few people that I invited just to share their own stories with going through such a challenging process, and then maybe we have time to discuss. So we'll see where it goes from there. Do you have questions so far?
Is this part of the research symposium?
Yes.
This is your research. This is your research topic.
This is, yes.
And so, are there other people presenting on their research topics too? My question is, since I came in late, is this part of the research symposia?
Yes.
Okay. And are there other people presenting their topics as well? Or is this the only topic?
I think the topic is recovery from brain injuries.
Okay.
And it's a research where I think it's more a applied research in terms of how do we deal as a community with this issue.
Okay.
And yes.
Okay. Not that I don't have any experience in related areas. I was really expecting more group process. And so this seems to be very much focused on perhaps family systems and some of the therapy that goes on in dealing with this injury. I'm just asking the question coming into this and really expecting more presenters than just one topic. So pardon me if I'm taking time off your agenda.
No, that's fine. So maybe I was wondering, Anasuya, would you want to start? Maybe just maybe help. That would be good.
So I'm Anasuya.
I asked Anasuya also because I don't know, we had a conference in April here. At PSU, and I know you shared your story, and I was really touched by the way you. The way you dealt with, or the way you learned from your story, and I was really very happy that you can share this.
Thanks, Pierre. I'm not sure exactly what I should say. Should I say how I got a brain injury, or how?
So what I was thinking, if you can and want, you can some of the story, what actually happened, and then also what was your experience of it, and what in your experience was helpful for you, and what was difficult.
And how long would you like me to share?
You have 10, 15 minutes.
Okay. I have no idea what I'm going to say. So, as I'm talking, if you have questions or whatever, just please ask. And I guess I'd just like to start with the present right now and say that my husband Dale is here, and, My injury occurred in 1982, and it's still daily quite in control of my life. My life centers around managing chronic pain and chronic sleep deprivation and chronic illness associated with having a brain and an immune system that doesn't function quite normally. So then I'll go back in time. So in 1982, I was gardening in my backyard, and somebody either in the house behind or the house directly next door shot a gun into the air, and the bullet ricocheted off the tree and went through my head. So I got shot in the head. And it's just so... I'm gonna come to the present again, and I just have to say that in the moment today, right now, I'm in a state where I normally would not come out of my house. I'm having a very difficult time for about the last 6 weeks with my health, and it's connected to the brain injury, but it's affecting my heart, and I'm not able to sleep more than 3 hours at night, and that's the only sleep I've gotten for several weeks now. So I have a fever and probably somewhere an infection. And one of the things, I don't know if this applies to other people, but for myself, the bullet, and then I fell onto concrete and fractured my neck and jaw and head in several places, thank you. And so there was massive injury to my brain, and one of my doctors describes it as your body, when you get an injury somewhere, your body's good at walling off that area, but you can't do that with the brain. So my brain injury is progressive. The cell death continues. And she said it's like an avalanche. And once the avalanche really gets going, it's very difficult to stop it. And so things that I'm very susceptible, medically speaking, I have a fragile brain. So right now it's a bit of a mystery what's going on. It's affecting my thyroid and my eyes and my heart and my whole endocrine system. And have a series of doctors trying to figure it out. So one of the results of that right now is that I'm a little spacey, and it's hard to think in a linear way. So I apologize for the fact that I'm like going back and forth. And if you want clarification, please ask me. So back to 1982, when I got shot, I was rushed to the hospital, and they didn't know if the bullet was still in my head or if it had come out, and so foreign body scan and all that, and it had come out. I have a big dent. It went through. It damaged the optic nerve, so I couldn't see for a while, and they didn't know if I'd get my vision back. And then I did slip into a coma a few hours later for a couple of weeks. And then I came out of the coma very slowly over a period of a couple of weeks. And that's the part I remember as being really, really difficult, because when I was in that other state of the coma, I was living a life, I guess, in my head. I had a completely different life. I don't know if I believe in past lives or multiple lives, but you could say I was living another life, and in great detail, and I can still remember it in great detail. And then I started being aware of people looking at me and moving their mouths. I couldn't hear anything, and these scenes started happening in front of me, which was the everyday reality, people caring for me and trying to get my attention. And it was in two dimensions, like watching TV. It just didn't seem real. And over a period of time, I had to realize that the dream I was having that I thought was real was the dream, And this two-dimensional weird world that was mostly just irritating to me was the world I was expected to enter back into, and that was quote-unquote real. And that process was really excruciating. Is there anything specific you'd like me to say, Pierre, about my experience of getting shot or how I recovered afterwards? Or
well, or whatever you want to share, but I remember the way you used also art and kind of process work, or use art in trying to embed this experience in a larger story of your life, and in finding a way to make sense of this experience from a larger perspective.
Yes.
Not just only as the victim of that experience itself, but also to find a way to embed it.
Yes.
In a thing.
Thank
I think
you.
that was really inspiring.
That reminds me that I brought something to hand out for people who are interested in, along those lines. And thank goodness for process work. Process work has really, really enabled me to take this experience that I still live with every day and use it in a way that's been really not only helpful in terms of dealing with the symptoms I have to deal with every day, but helpful in terms of my personal growth and finding meaning. And I'll just pass these around, and you can take one if you like it. It's some artwork and some little quotes from me about the artwork and how it helps me. And it's interesting that, I mean, process work has a theory that I guess came from Jung, and then process work has elaborated on that, that you have a life myth, or you're born into your life with a pattern that you will work on for your whole life, and it has a theme. And that's really been true for me. And when I was a process work student, I was really intrigued with that because I had a childhood dream from the time I was really young, and it repeated. It was like a nightmare. And in that dream, I got shot. Thank you. Shot at by the mafia, the whole mafia. And in that dream, to get away from the mafia, I flew up into the air and became one with the sky, and it was a very peaceful experience. And that is very similar to what I experienced when I actually got shot.
So that was actually a dream that you had as a child.
Yes.
Many, many years before.
Yes.
Having the experience of being shot.
Yes.
Oh, wow.
And then when I got shot, it was a similar experience of leaving my body. There's a picture of it in here. It's this one is my childhood dream. It's me in the sky at 5 years old. That's a real photo of me, and that's the age I was when I had the dream.
Maybe describe the picture
for people that are listening online.
Yeah,
okay, great. So the picture is a little disjointed looking on purpose because the dream was disjointed feeling. It's a lot of brick buildings and a lot of gangster type people pointing guns in the air, climbing around and going to the rooftop and standing on the rooftop and pointing in the air. And then there's me at 5 years old just sort of floating in the sky. And so this is sort of a theme for my life, that I have these two experiences. One is pain in my body, or the fear of how I'm going to make it through the night with a lot of pain. Sometimes it's similar to the energy of the mafia. And then the other part, the other experience I have is a very strong altered state type of experience where I become one with the whole sky. On the cover of this is piece of artwork I did that's my earliest childhood memory. And I'm in my crib, and there's light coming in through the bedroom window onto the crib, and I realize in my memory, I realize that my skin is just too tight and I don't really fit, and I let myself ooze out of my skin in the form of light particles, and I join the moonbeams and I float up into the sky, and I become one with the entire night sky, and it's an ecstatic experience. Also very similar to what I experienced when I got shot. I shot backwards through a long dark tunnel and ended up merging with the light. So I think it's fascinating that I have this pattern of this dualities, the painful, constricted, restricted one, and then the totally free, no boundaries, no body one. So I've worked with that process a lot in using process work methods, and it's really helped me and helped me work with my pain and some difficult nights by consciously being able to just leave my body or get bigger than my body so that my pain in proportions seems much smaller. Just on the back of this, there's a picture of a mandala, and that contains main elements from artwork I did over a period of several years where I was working on trying to discover my life myth more clearly, what the symbols were, and these were recurrent symbols in different artwork. So, you know, I think not everybody has as dramatic of a history as I do, but I think we all have some sort of pattern, of theme, something that's difficult for us in some way that we feel whole. And for me, those two things were able to come together in the mandala so that I see that it's really one whole experience with different parts. And that has really, really helped me live with my chronic issues, to see that I don't have to wall off the parts that I'm unhappy with, that that's part of me and that's part of my path, and to also try to bring the parts that I enjoy, the experiences I enjoy, into my day, even if it's a painful day. Oh, thank you. Oh, yeah, thanks, Katja. Yeah, on my website I have a lot of the artwork that led to this mandala and the artwork in these pamphlets. So it's my name, anusuyastarbear.com. It's A-N-U-S-U-Y-A, starbear, like a star and a bear.
Are there any questions for Anusuya? Maybe we'll have. Yeah.
I'm slow actually to take it in and then see what questions might bubble up, because you know, I also know you personally and your story is very moving. But I think like the questions that come up for me are like more practical also, like maybe, I mean, this has been a long time, right? 82, so that's like, we're going on 30 years, wow. And so I'm also thinking if, I don't even know if it's too big of a question, but maybe stages that you've gone through and what on a practical level in terms of other treatments that have been helpful or things like support in relationship or something like that.
Thanks, Katja. What was interesting, after the initial recovery from the injury, which I would say was maybe like between 1 and 2 years, I was just sort of told to get on with my life, and there wasn't as much knowledge then or where I was living about what to do after a head injuries that was around now. And I didn't know anybody else who'd had a head injury. And so I got really good at not showing my symptoms and trying to act quote-unquote normal. And then about 10 years later, I started having grand mal seizures and a couple of complex seizures as well. But because I go into such an altered state when I'm having the seizures, I didn't really know what was happening. And because I had an attitude with the very few people that knew about my head injury and my struggle with the symptoms, that we just don't talk about this. I just try to go on and act normal. So even my my ex-husband, who would see me have grand mal seizures, he knew that when I went into that state, I wanted everybody to leave the room, don't talk about it afterward, leave me alone, I'm exhausted, I need to recover, don't touch me, don't talk to me. And I have gone to lots of doctors since the injury. I like to use alternative medicine, but all sorts of doctors. And I was on different medications and supplements, and he just assumed that I knew I had epilepsy, that the doctors knew that I was being treated for it. Well, no, it was almost, it was recent, Dale. How many years ago was it? I had a seizure in my doctor's office just maybe 3 years ago. That was the first time anybody knew I had seizures. I had gone untreated all that time, and it had gotten to the point where I was having them nearly every night, and sometimes clusters of them, and I developed chronic fatigue and severe problems with my spine and things because I just really thrash around and hurt myself. So being on medication and not having seizures, except in extreme circumstances now, has made huge difference in my pain levels, in my energy level, in my body's ability to cope with other stimulus and things. Do you want to say anything, Dale? Yeah, it's difficult. It's very expensive being me. Especially, thank goodness, we are lucky enough to have health insurance, but a lot of the treatments that I use are not covered. I spend more every month on medication than I do on food. And I have lots of toys and devices just to help me get through the night, a special bed, a hot tub, a thing to hang upside down, you name it, you know. And I still feel, this is a big deal for me, especially since it's being recorded, I still feel a lot of shame. And I don't talk about this part of myself, and I get really down on myself. My phrase I use is I feel like a puppy from the pound. You know, you think it's really cute and you buy it and you take it home and then you find out it has hip dysplasia and worms and it has emotional problems and it costs you a ton of money. And so I feel like that puppy, and I can get... Well, I hide out when I feel needy, and it's a big deal for me to come tonight when I'm not really feeling my best. So I came because I really appreciate that you guys bring this topic up. It's so marginalized, and it needs to be talked about, and I'm really looking forward to hearing other people's stories. So thanks for caring and for listening.
Thank you. It's really deep. Mm-hmm. Coming out just in public with such a long story and challenge is huge. It's huge. Well, Maybe because how about we ask the question also more?
Just one question, sir.
Yes.
I'm concerned about, do you have enough support now?
Oh, great. Thank you.
Who are your support? I mean, does your family support you? What about others?
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, I have wonderful grandsons, but I don't even tell them what I'm dealing with. I'm very private about it. So just a couple people in my life, and I work at home, and I am a process worker and a therapist, and I work with people who have brain injuries and chronic illness, and I'm very happy doing that, and I work in my own environment so I can care for myself well, have a half an hour between clients usually, and so I've developed a rhythm in my life that is geared around how to care for myself, and thank you for asking.
Thank you. Sweet. I don't know.
It just makes me want to thank you all the more for coming out and sharing your experiences, and especially, you know, because they are invisible and on many levels, so you're having to make them visible. Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you. Yes, thanks. I don't know. I was wondering if you, Carl, could also share some of your story. Would that be good? Thank you. Carl and I know each other a year now. And we've been working together for this year. And so I asked him if he would be willing to come and share some of his story. It's great. Thanks.
I'll try to be as articulate as possible, but I'm still in the thick of this.
Yes.
My brain's a little bit mixed up. My lung collapsed while I was riding a bicycle, and I ran a red light and got hit by a car. 3 weeks in a coma, and 6 months in the hospital afterwards. It was a very amazing experience. I mean, it was horrible. I mean, I couldn't have asked for anything worse to happen, but there's so much to be taken from it. There's so many opportunities to learn things, and I had to relearn all sorts of things. I played the piano for 25 years before the accident, and I had to relearn how to play. I'm learning it better the second time. It's true. It's like I have hindsight, but I don't know the answer. It's very strange. It's very strange duality. So anything having to do with relationships or responsibilities or anything of that sort, having to relearn all of those processes again and experiencing them almost like a dream, like you're trying to apply your awareness and your intelligence in a dream to do something, you just don't really feel as empowered as you once were. Like your arms and legs don't quite work as well. But I'm blessed and I feel no pain. My brain still works intelligently somehow. It's not very well organized, but it has to buckle down and think about something that can work that way. I work from home. I'm a product designer. So my life works out okay. My wife has been tremendously supportive. I'm sorry she couldn't be here. Yes. We have a 5-year-old daughter, so it's been very difficult for us to balance the responsibilities as they have changed dramatically. I can't drive anymore, this and that. So I've become an all-star housewife. I do what I can. It is possible to balance the pole and make it work. even though it's so different. This happened 2 years ago. And all the doctors said that it was real bad. It was a really severe brain injury. And they can't believe that I'm healing the way that I'm healing. So again, although it was so bad, it's still a blessing that it happened in a way. How it happened. Had the accident happened any other way, I would have been so much worse off. It's very strange. When lots and lots of bad luck adds up to good luck. So when I thought about addressing people with brain injury, I really want to ask them to look for opportunities in their healing process to develop new things in their lives, because the process of healing can inform so much, so many new ways of doing things. If you're patient with yourself and really work through it cautiously and calmly, you can learn from your struggle. I really don't have too much more to say that I can think of.
That's big. Maybe there's going to be maybe also a time for, you know, sure, for discussion afterwards. But does anybody have a questions right away? Or yes.
It's interesting. I've had a few conversations lately with people who are close in my. Who are close in my life who've been really questioning the meaning of why certain events are happening and what is the larger purpose with our consciousness expansion or how we're supposed to be growing at this time in history. And you said, it's curious, or I don't know if I'm paraphrasing you correctly, but how many bad events can result in something good or positive. So could you elaborate a little bit more? I know I've had my own health challenges, certainly not to the extent that you're describing, but I do have that very different life experience where I understand what it takes to have hope when there's hopelessness and tremendous fear.
It's sometimes hard to have hope anyway without anything bad happening. It's hard to look for that. But if you look for that in the context of very bad occurrences, it takes a lot of strength to get there, yeah, to look at that. But it's still there. It hasn't left.
What gives you that strength? Do you know?
I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Questions?
I just, when I look at you or when I hear you talk, I get such a feeling of peace and joy from you, and really appreciate that, and especially in light of what you've gone through. And I'm just wondering, do you have any memories of being in a different state during the trauma of the accident?
Yes, I have a very, very visual memory of almost my spirit leaving my body and my body recovering to a point where the spirit could go back to it. So I felt some distance. I don't know how to describe it more than that, but...
Thank you. Yeah.
It's like my spirit would have spun off and gone to another body. But this body recovered well enough for it to be able to be inhabited by the same spirit, so it didn't fly off and go somewhere else. It came back.
I don't know if this is possible to answer this, and I don't know if I'm going to ask it in a way that's clear, but when you talk about your body and your spirit, Did you experience that by being identified with either one when that's happening, like you're the body or you're the spirit or you're just outside holding all of it?
I didn't identify with one or the other. It's a very strange time to recall. I'm not sure that I can really identify exactly what I was feeling, but it's the best I can describe.
Yeah, thank you. 30-something years later, however many years later, after my out-of-body near-death experience, I'm still learning about that, you know, for myself, what that meant or what that was. And so thank you for sharing. Yeah, I'm just interested.
Thanks. And I don't know if Matt, do you want to share some of your...
Sure.
That what we just
thinking about it.
Yeah, yeah. Thanks. And may, you know, we might also have then also more time to just discuss afterwards together.
So I had something happen to me when I was 20. I'm 41 now. So it's not that I don't remember it. I just don't think about it as often as I used to. I've been working with Pierre. And it just dawned on me the other day. And it's probably because it's coming up, but it was November 9th.
The time of the year.
Yeah.
But November 9th is when the accident happened.
Yeah, it was also the day the Brandenburg Gates fell. So I was a 20-year-old political science major at U of O. It was kind of bizarre, but I had a car accident, and I left the road at about 60 miles an hour, and the car went 150 feet, so it was about half a football field, and it rolled end over end and sideways. And so I had a Kui Ku, and, you know, this was 1989, but the passenger got the neighbor, called 911. The ambulance, luckily, was at the bottom of the hill. It was up on a hill, and right out of town in Eugene, and it only took them 6 minutes to get there, but I was probably to the hospital in half an hour or something, and they saved me. Spent a couple days in a coma, about 9 days in Eugene, and I was transferred to Emmanuel, to the head injury rehab program, which had just kind of started, I think, at the time. And but they had a trauma center. That was the place with the trauma center, so that was, you know, where I did the learning how to walk again. But I did, I didn't really, I didn't check the dates. I just was talking to Pierre about this. And it was the 9th that the gate fell. So I really hadn't been paying attention. It was like a Friday night in Eugene, so we were thinking about other stuff. And to wake up from a coma and kind of, you know, a couple days more to come to, and I remember finally when I got up to Manuel, we had, I had a private room, and luckily I had car insurance that paid for all this stuff. But on CNN was, you know, as I'm coming to my new reality, was it was new for everyone. It's kind of strange. So anyway, thinking about this, it happens every November, and I, you know, have a hard time getting through it. But this is 21 years. But anyway, spent 10 years trying to regain normal, if that makes any sense to people. and went back to work and did a lot of things and graduated from college in the meantime, and, you know, was successful in different pursuits. And then about 2001, I had a grand mal seizure. So I've spent 10 years of my life now trying to regain normal from epilepsy. So
sorry to interrupt. I just want to appreciate all the feeling that you're expressing, and it's very moving to hear you and see you, and I somehow just want to encourage you to feel free. And thank you for sharing so much.
But yeah, and I had kind of forgotten, as I was saying, the Brandenburg Gates fell on that date. But it was kind of important to me as a poli-sci major and studying a lot of international relations class. I pretty much had to, go incomplete on a full class load, unfortunately, and return to school the next term. It was a different focus on poli-sci international relations classes all changed after that. The history was history. That it was, instead of a system, it was history, I guess, at that point. So. with help from UVO and some rehab and learning how to walk and talk again and getting back and a lot of help from friends and family, I was successful at a lot of things, but didn't know, that I was epileptic. So at the point when I had my grandma's seizure for the first time in 2001, I'd probably been having seizures in my sleep for years and I didn't know about it because I was waking up in the middle of the night having a reoccurring horrible dream, basically. And I had gone to have a sleep study done, and they, you spend the night there and they hook you up. And there was nothing they could do for me as far as a CPAP, positive air pressure machine, or even the surgery they recommended against it, because your throat will grow back. So the recommendation was to lose 10 pounds and basically... the sleep apnea will hopefully go away. But there was more to it than that. I was having rare spikes in my sleep. My EEG showed rare spikes. But then again, this is another term. In 1989, I have the medical reports. They termed it a mild to moderate head injury. Well, my head, although they didn't have to drill a hole in it, they were very close to having to do that. It was 5 times normal. And so, mild to moderate, I don't know whose definition is mild to moderate, And then, like, when you look at an EEG, what does the word rare mean in the application to the word spike? Is it an adjective that means doesn't happen very often, or is it that it's a rare as in very abnormal or bad? I'm not sure. So I've got these medical reports that kind of say what they need to say, but that's being interpreted different ways, and I can't get any, they don't help me any, you do what you can, and I'm on a good medicine now that's taking care of my seizures, although that was a trial because I had to go through 2 different medications. I'm on my second one, and so that is a success, I suppose, but. That did take a couple years, and it's been a tough 10 years. So anyway, that's part of what I wanted to say. I was going to think of something else that you were talking about.
May I ask a question?
Yes.
Brian, your name's Brian?
Matthew.
Sorry. Matthew, excuse me, I'm Crystal. I'm missing an important piece of context, and that is I don't know what the Brandenburg Gates falling, what is that? Could you describe it to me? Please.
I don't know. How old were you in 1989? Yeah, I guess I was 20. We were taking side bets amongst each other and when it would happen, watching Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia fall. independent states in Russia. To put it bluntly, shit was going to hit the fan at some point. So, you know, it just so happened. It happened that same day. And I wasn't really paying attention, but by the time I came to 10 days later, I'm in a room at Emmanuel and CNN's on, and not only am I trying to make sense of what's happened to me, losing 10 days, but they're chiseling the wall. People are flooding into West Germany.
Is that
partying?
Another?
It's going on. It's happening. The world has changed.
So,
and I'm digesting this all at the same time I'm digesting my own personal experience in relation to the hospital room and parents looking at me like this and doctors looking at me like this. And the world was a strange place all at the same moment in time, I guess is what I'm saying.
So just for geographical context, the Brandenburg Gate was the main gate between East and West Germany in Berlin.
It's the wall.
It's the wall.
I didn't realize there was a gate.
There was the wall, and then there was a Brandenburg thing, which is a big square in the midst of Berlin, and where the wall went across the Brandenburg, in the midst of the Brandenburg, and the wall went. At that place, there was not a wall. There were just big fences, electrical fences.
Thank
and things.
You.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Matthew.
Mm-hmm. In Berlin. Yeah, it's a big...
Enormous, yes.
So yeah, I did. I've been working more with epilepsy than brain injury in the last 10 years. But that's my story. And I had something else that I was going to mention in regard to which the topics you were brought up. But if I think of it, I'll mention it.
Yeah. Maybe if you think of afterwards. But also one of the points that you mentioned, which is important when you say, you know, the context of how you get classified as mild or moderate brain injury, or how doctors interpret some of the spikes in the EEG, have huge consequences regarding your chances to be recognized as a person with a head injury and a disability and be recognized for Social Security. So that's one of the, you know, it has huge consequences if, you know, what you say might have a direct impact on your chance to be seen or to be recognized as someone who deserves, but, you know, Social Security or not. So Social Security insurance, I mean, disability insurance, and having insurance, Social Security, is a very good thing for many people, but can be also a curse for others. You know, there's also good and bad things about Social Security insurance. So, but it's relevant in this context. Yeah, you might.
Well, I thought of what. The common experience of leaving your body, I guess, was what I had left out, yeah. And at the point when I was fishtailing off the road, it was, again, in November, a cold, a dark night, and leaves on the road. And I had turned too sharp, and so the car went off to the right. I was taking a right turn, and went off to the right, and down into a ditch and flipped into a grassy field on a farm. And... I left my body at the moment the car basically left the road and hit the ditch, basically flying into the air. So, don't have any memory of the firefighters or the friend who saved me or the farmer, but kind of remember floating until I came back to Eugene in the hospital, basically. And then I don't know if this is tied in at all, but when I go home sometimes in my dreams to my childhood home, I'll have the same reoccurring dream where basically I return home by falling through the chimney and wake up as I'm basically falling down a dark vertical shaft until I hit the bottom and then I wake up. And those used to be the panic attacks when I used to wake up. having either seizures or sleep apnea, I'm not sure, or some combination of both. But it was always to the childhood home. And those are the two thoughts I had, I guess, on that.
Well, thank you very much for sharing. It's really, I don't know how you feel, but I feel something, I feel given. I feel that I've been, and it's very inspiring. It's touching to hear deep stories like that and how you all deal with a big challenge. And so there's a big learning for me. I don't know exactly how to formulate what I'm learning, but just experiencing you here and sharing this in itself is very meaningful to me. It's important. Yeah, you want to say?
I also experienced that sense of being given something. I've known you for years and years, Anasuya. I laid in your bed once when I was going through a really hard time in my life, and I had no idea these things that you experience. And I think just immediately I feel like the gift of the hiddenness of it is that every time I walk down the street, every time I have an encounter with somebody, I'll wonder what their story is. And I just have a deeper curiosity about every single person that I meet. So thank you so much.
Touching.
Yeah. And maybe to share more of myself. Too.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Other comments, questions? At this point, I just want to open it up for us to ponder, to discuss. Yes.
I don't want to go into it too much, or I don't know how much to go into, I guess, but I think there's another side of this whole thing.
Yes.
And that's the side of, well, in my case, of the spouse. Mm-hmm. And I can tell from my experience, I don't know how other is, but on this side of the whole thing, it's a pretty horrendous experience. And as much work as they're putting into the recovery of the people with the brain injury, I sure hope that it's coupled, that there's work being coupled with the people who are working, who are living with those people. And well, anyway, I just hope that that aspect of this whole thing is being looked at also.
Thank you. Yeah, this needs to come out too, because that's part of the whole story is how it affects the individual, but then how it affects the whole family and the person, the people around the person who is injured. And I don't know about you, but in my experience, working with a lot of family members, sometimes they will tell me, or they have told me, that they don't feel that they have a place to share their story, because the story of the one who's been injured has more dominance, or is more central in some ways, because you didn't get injured, but you did. You did in other ways, but it's often seen as less valued or less important, because the focus is primarily on the person who has the injury from it and has to be at in the beginning, but the effect is huge on the family. So I'm really appreciative that you bring that up.
I want to add one thing to that. The way I realize how I said that about the horrendous part, and I have to agree with Carl in that there's a tremendous learning experience behind the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I often forget that, but in my moments of sanity and clarity, there is this huge learning experience that there's this huge opportunity, and I just wanted to make sure that side of the, I didn't want to leave it with the horrendous side, but I wanted to also balance it out that I'm aware of this other side of things. But there's still a support process there that it's tough. It's really tough. Oftentimes.
I do hear you. What's that? I do hear you, and I do know that, yeah.
Dale, I just didn't know if you had any direct recommendations. You said, you know, I hope as much research is going into the caregivers and their experiences. And I was just wondering if from your own you have thoughts of what's helpful for caregivers.
Yeah, I do. I'm a very opinionated person here. And I find this is my own personal experience. I don't know how other people work with it or deal with it. But I'm seriously think that the opportunity to share your story with other people who are willing to listen is a major piece of what I guess you could call it the healing process for the non-injured person. I don't know what else to say about it. I have found that when you have a really traumatic story, if you start to go into it, most people just sort of start to glaze over. You can kind of see it happen. And, you know, it's the kind of thing that most people don't really want to deal with. I mean, I don't really want to deal with it. I can understand that in a way. But the opportunity to be able to share the story with people who are really going to listen. They don't have to do anything with it, but just it makes you feel like you're not alone. And that's the primary, that would be number one. And I suppose any caregiver is going to, at some point, be overwhelmed with some emotional impact of the people that they're working with. Well, I'll leave it at that one. That's probably the number one thing, I think.
That's deep, and in a way that was actually kind of the motivation for me to bring this together in a way, is to be able to have a place where we can hear and listen to these stories from all the different perspectives. This is really one of my main reason to, you know, when you asked to do that, because I do know and I do see how important that is, that we hear each other's stories. meaning felt. And as you said, not everybody is really able to listen and to hear this, and it's hard to find the right environment and the right place for people to be open, and we have to care for each other. And I think as a person who's been, you also have to, it's kind of paradoxical, you are the victim, but you also have to care for the people around you, in a way. We share that role. It's not just something that is on one side or the other.
We think, you know, in process work, we have the concept of the city shadow, which is, you know, those people who are carrying, who usually hold a lot of stigma from society and are carrying marginalized experiences for the whole. And I'm thinking that this being mostly invisible, both the people who have gone through, you know, severe experiences and those who are caring for those who have gone, is another city shadow. And all of the altered states or slowness, or it's like a lot of the things, right, that we, or, you know, don't want to face. Death, our death, the things that like interrupt that pace and drive, are all the things that are kind of valued. And you know, I'm just talking out loud, connecting the dots of the added intensity to that invisibility and where maybe I guess it comes from.
Well, I appreciate you all being very patient with me arriving late. And I'm relatively new to the process work community here. I'm really struck by the stories that have been shared tonight. And I'm also reflecting a lot on the stage of my life and coming to terms with some of my own story. And certainly being marginalized in many respects. I lost my father at a very young age. I was molested by my father at a very young age. I had a lot of, you know, shame and concern about that experience. I went through a lot of health crises, dealing with the medical profession, just, you know, adversity that most people don't really relate to. So it was kind of a stigma, I would say. At a very young age, you know, 21, 24, dealing with all of this and coming into the world, and it's like, okay, this part of myself no one can really deal with, and many people can't. And, you know, I was just having a conversation with a good friend of mine recently, telling her a little bit about my past. She's like, wow, that's really intense. And I said, you know, most people can't handle my story. I mean, I just don't tell anyone. And to think about it in this context of being marginalized by society and the extra burden that we place on ourselves because it's out there, it's some karma, it's some shameful thing that's happened to us, when on the other hand, it's made me who I am. And it has allowed me to experience tremendous spiritual growth and tremendous depth in my awareness about myself and consciousness and empathy and energy and vibration and empathy that I would have no clue about. So it's just very interesting to think about marginalization and the sense of what is the meaning through adversity that we come to. That's all our own. That's a very unique expression of ourselves as human beings, spiritual beings. That's what's just circulating in my mind and experience. And again, I appreciate what you've shared tonight. It's been very heartfelt and just really opened my heart in a way that I haven't experienced ever. So thank you very much. Mm-hmm.
Thanks. Thank you, too. I mean, that question is such a huge question, and your comment. How do we make sense of the adversity? But it shapes us and makes who we are. But then it's often difficult to express it or to share it. And how do we, as a community, support each other with all our own diversity, and some of which is traumatic, but it's also who we are. Yeah, it's a big. I like that.
You wanna? How long ago was it that you were studying traumatic brain injury?
Me?
Yes.
When
the program was actually helping people, you were...
Right. I mean, I finished my medical school in 84. I think I was working in this hospital.
In the 80s?
89 to 94.
Okay. I'm just curious. What the potential for research is, and how about the gentlemen and ladies in the, you know, in the armed services who have had surgery? Are they getting anywhere near the kind of treatment that you discussed, you think, at Ramstein or at any of the field hospitals or any of the military hospitals? Are they in any way getting anything approaching what you guys did back then?
I'm not sure. In my experience, how much I understand the medical structures and system in the United States, they are pretty different than they are in Switzerland. So they're more disparate, there's a bigger gap between these very good centers who the best care possible exists. But they're pretty rare, and they are there for a small group of people, the most privileged people. So there exists this really highest level of care and highest of specialized care. And but for the larger public, for the most people, that type of care is not accessible, and it's not. And in the military service, the information that we and that you hear in the newspaper is that a lot of this is starting to be recognized, but there's a lot of stories of people who have a huge difficulty to be seen with the issues, and they feel pushed away, they feel sent from one doctor to the other and not really accepted and recognized with the issue. There's a big political dimension to it, because if you realize that you know the military has then the responsibility to take care of, and so there's a political dimension to it, and it's also some of the doctors and some of the doctors in Iraq and in Afghanistan, you know, take people back into duties because they don't want to recognize this really the depths of the issue, and so it's a big topic.
Also, as you're saying that, Pierre, I'm realizing that. Your brain injury is 2 years old, so it's fairly new, but you and I have been dealing with ours for a long time. And Brain injury is something that, like you said, is chronic, but it also often gets worse as time goes by. After the initial really bad stage, you know, epilepsy tends to develop later on, years later. I have a lot more problems now than I did for the first 5 years after I got shot. So that's another issue. And then it's hard to diagnose later because, I mean, there's no question that I got shot in the head. I have proof of that. But there's a big question about when I go to a medical person about if my problem is related to that. Yes. And then, of course, with the state that we have in the United States of the, you know, not everybody has equal access to care. And I have a big fear about what would happen to me if I lost medical insurance. I'm not qualified for disability. I've tried. They won't give it to me. So it's a huge political issue. I just wanted to say, yeah, it's complicated.
It's very complicated, very complex, and very multidimensional, and you're absolutely right. And there's so little knowledge about how the brain heals and the self-healing capacity of the brain, and each individual injury is so different from one another, so there's... It's very hard to make these causal connections and links because you can't put them in one specific category, and then really then you know it's going to be that, you know, for some people it gets worse, some people get actually better, and it doesn't, and we don't know. I mean, in the hospital was... We would see people with you know, brain injuries and scans, and we saw their brains in the different, you know, CT scans. We didn't have MRIs at that time, but we saw the different damages to the brain, and for some, we saw huge changes in these pictures, but the people were doing pretty well. And then we saw people where we couldn't see any, we didn't see much of the changes in the brain structures from a visual, you know, from these scans. And people were really in a very difficult position and place. So there was really, it's very hard to make this correlation between the objective damage to the brain and the consequences in your experience, but in your health over a long time. And so that's often then being used to say, well, it's not really, there's no causal connection. And if you work with people with brain injury, you know that there are causal connections because it's an evidence that you know the people have these difficulties, but to make a proof, to make the different links is often very hard and sometimes impossible. So then the disability insurances and say, well, you can't prove it. So they deny certain services, or they deny certain things.
And the other aspect too, or another aspect is, I mean, I've been diagnosed by a neurologist with a fragile brain, whatever that means. But a couple years ago, I got in a car accident, which would have been serious for anybody. That's a head-on with a big, serious, you know, whiplash. And for me, it's really serious because I already had broken my neck and I already had brain damage. And so there's an issue, too, about how once you have an injury that affects your whole body like that, then you're more susceptible to future damage, you know, from... So, I mean, I don't know where I'm going with it other than I just want to say it, because the whole thing is so invisible and so marginalized. Yeah.
Big point. Big point. We have another few more minutes. I don't know if there's any closing comments or... Katya.
That's just what I'm wondering too. Or how's everybody doing? And as we, you know, it's a lot to hear and share and so many feelings and intense stories. Like, we've already been on these journeys together tonight. So just wondering if as we kind of part each other's company, if anything needs to be said or shared.
I just wanted to ask you a question. Do you know of any support groups for spouses of, I don't know, doesn't have to be brain injury, but traumatic, traumatic injury, chronic pain, that kind of thing?
I do.
Do you? I'd like to get that from you afterwards.
Okay, great.
Great. Do you want to say it right now?
I can't. I'm sorry.
Okay.
I have to retrieve the information from somewhere else.
Yeah. Right. That's what I was thinking when you were talking earlier. If one existed, which I'm imagining there, I feel like I've heard of caregivers of people dealing with cancer before. But then I thought, what an incredible organization to start also. Yeah.
There's a brain injury association of Oregon of some sort.
Yeah, BIOBIAOR.
That's it. And they have a full... I'm sorry. Here you go, say it.
BIAOR, and I just looked it up online, and I think it's probably a .org. It's Brain Injury Association of Oregon.
They have a catalog of support groups for patients or for... the brain injured in their support groups, mm-hmm. and their supporters.
So there's different resources on the internet.
Yes.
There's also the American Brain Injury Association, and I mean, you know a lot.
Yeah, they even publish a newsletter. I think it's called The Headliner. Yeah.
The Headliner.
I mean, I think I found it, you linked to the one, something about brain injury and coma, something on Facebook.
Yes, there's different groups on Facebook, and I was, I forgot to bring the information, but I heard there's a regular brain injury radio talk show that is on Monday evenings. That you can, well, the Hearing Voices is a radio. It's about more about the psychiatric health issues. But there's another, and I just saw that today on Facebook, that there's a radio show, and 1 hour long. It's on Monday evening. But I could send that link to people who are interested.
Pierre, could you just give your website? I must be the marketing link tonight, but for people who are listening, could you give your website and also email address so people could contact you?
So, yes, my webpage is called creativehealing.org, and there's a few resources on that, and but I also... created a brain injury recovery Facebook page that people can be connected to, and there's certain links on that page. And now,
your email address.
My email address is pmorin, P-M-O-R-I. No, it's Pierre. Sorry, it's my work email. Yeah. Pierre@creativehealing.org.
Okay. And I just wanted to say thank you to the three of you. It was really quite amazing to listen to you and the learning and the relearning and your sense of going forward and then all the feelings and all the images, the wall coming down and relearning the piano and the artwork. I mean, it's just astounding. And I sort of think of myself just going along in my little life like this, and then wham, you all bring in these incredible experiences that just take you off the, like sort of off the grid. And so I just really appreciate you bringing those in.
Thank you. Well, is that the time? Do you want to say something? You just had the mic. I'm not sure if
I'm holding it.
You're holding it. That's great. That's great. We need a mic holder. Thank you,
so
everybody.
So well speaking into Thank the you. Mic. Thank you. And we the people who around the world are listening, I'm sure, also thank us. So,
and thank you, Katya, so for organizing this and organizing also the technical side to make sure that it gets recorded. And I think this is available for free. It will be available on as a podcast download.
Yeah, I'll send out a message to the local string when it's available. And anyone who's not on those strings, if you want to give me your email, I can email you directly so that you can listen to it afterwards if you want to. Yeah, so thank you again for all that you've shared. Pierre, for coming, Anasuya, Carl, Matt, and everybody also for taking it in. And yeah, thank you. Okay.